Mini episode 194 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to mini episode number 194 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. Here today we've got a very entertaining segment that will be coming your way. We have a guest that we've been looking forward to getting on the program for a while now. She was very kind enough to send a copy of her book out to us, and we've been making the most of that. This is a guest today, and this is going to make for a very, very interesting discussion. That we really have a lot of things in common with, and that's always something that could be looked at in many different kinds of ways, whether it be experiences or anything. But in this way, what we have in common with her is an approach to how we do what we do. And it's very, very interesting because she is a journalist who is very much in the mold of conversational type of interviews. And so consequently, with two people like that, she and I, that's exactly what you're going to get today. It's not something that's really the norm in this industry, kind of sadly, in my estimation. A lot of times, to whatever extent, it's still kind of question, answer, question, answer, question, answer when you're dealing with somebody. But we've always preferred a more conversational approach, and she does as well. And that really shines through in her work. And her book is One-on-One, My Journey with Hall of Famers, Fan Favorites, and Rising Stars. She is a 27-time Emmy winner, and it is a pleasure to have on the show today sports broadcaster and interviewer Jane Mitchell. Jane, welcome to the FDH Lounge. Pleasure to have you on, ma'am.
Hi, Rick. It's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so much. It's great to have you on the program. Greatly enjoyed your book. Thank you very much for sending it, inscribing it, et cetera. It was very, very eye-opening as far as, you know, your experiences, what you had been through, the channel that you had basically helped bring to life that is hosting the show. So as far as, again, the experience that led up to deciding to write the book, it was very interesting how you were talking about it and what the process was in the book. But for the sake of the listeners, break it down for us, please, what your thoughts were on just going through the experiences that you'd had, the conversations, and how you decided to bring those to life in the book.
Well, sure. Thank you. Just to bring people up to speed, in 1997, Cox Communications went into partnership, and we launched with the San Diego Padres a television station to cover the team. I was not a sports fan to start. I kind of tolerated sports. You know, I figured my boyfriends liked it. Okay, I'll go along with it. But when I had this amazing opportunity to help connect the fans with the players, I ran with it. And I was given the opportunity to do a show. So the show was called One-on-One with me. And the idea was to really tell the story of the players, who they are as people, how they, you know, nobody just shows up and becomes a Hall of Famer, or let alone just becomes a major leaguer. So I really just was me, quite frankly. I didn't want to be like anyone else. I wasn't going to be the girl, the sideline stats girl. That wasn't me. I was interested in storytelling. And when I was given the opportunity to sit down with these players in their homes and with no time limit, really, it gave us the opportunity to have a conversation. Did I do my research? Of course. Did I want to know a lot of details and ask questions that maybe many people would be curious about? Yes. But the nice thing was we were never in a position, rarely, where we were rushed. So we had the chance to explore things that came out of conversations just by listening, which I think most really powerfully and strong interviewers that I've watched over the years, the ones I've admired and respected are the ones who listen. They're prepared, but they listen more than they're ready for their next question. So I just sort of evolved and developed my interviewing skills and approach, but really it was just the chance to tell these stories. And it wasn't just the interview that ended up on the show. In an hour and a half, you have to dissect it a lot. So I really got to the essence of who they were as people, their influences, and I wrote. It was a very highly produced show. So it is a biography show. And about 5 years down the road, they were asking me, what's it like to sit down with Tony Gwynn or with Ken Caminiti, who was my first one-on-one, or when I had the opportunity to interview Ted Williams, what were those experiences like? And what's your background? So someone said, my mom included, you ought to write a book. And I thought, gosh, a book, huh? So by the time I did it for a decade, I thought, 10 years, that's pretty good. But most people, in my humble opinion, probably weren't going to be that curious about me, and certainly not people outside of San Diego. What I really wanted to focus on was the players and sharing their stories. So once I got the approval to use the script, I selected 40 of my most notable of my, turns out to be 100 interviews, 125 people, but 100 interviews. And I said, I'm going to make that the bulk of the book. And of course, in the meantime, I told my story and how I got there and my philosophy about interviewing and storytelling, and put in a whole lot of pictures and a whole lot of hours, and got the 638-page book that is now available for any and all people interested in great sports biographies and maybe even a few journalists out there.
It's a great book. It's a thick one. It'll keep people reading it for quite a while, certainly, with all the stories that you've mined. And I think you put your finger on it exactly, Jane, as far as when you talk about listening and when you talk about that, because it gives you, if you're going to do the conversational style as you do and as I like to do, it allows you to go in and kind of take from something that they said. And it may not be anything that you'd even thought of ahead of time, but yeah, sometimes they will say something along those lines that you can use. But it's a thing where I'm kind of struck by a little bit of a coincidence here. I want to get your thoughts on this as far as what your background was coming into this, because you identified in the conversation just now, as you did in the book, to some degree, about how you really weren't much into sports, and maybe that's an understatement, before you really started going in this direction. And I'm struck by coincidence, because one of our favorite guests we've had on the show previously, and just happens to coincidentally to have been one of our female guests, Liz Klayman of Fox Business, talking about it sounded kind of similar in some ways, because she'd been on the local TV trajectory, maybe kind of similar to you. She'd never done business before she went to CNBC, and she felt like she kind of came at it from a fresher perspective that way. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering for you, do you get the same kind of sense with sports that, the fact that you weren't a lifelong sports fan, do you think it allowed you to come at it in a fresher way and be more amenable to the conversational style, or do you get the sense if you'd been into it all along that it probably would have played out the same way?
No, I do think that, and I'll tell you why. I think a lot of people who would come up to me and say, oh, my gosh, Jane, you have the best job in the world. I would love it if I got to sit down and talk to the players. I never had that infatuation or fanaticism or, whatever you want to call it, of a real sports fan. I looked at these people as professionals who had worked hard, who followed a dream, who had something to learn and something to teach. And I think, when I interviewed Ted Williams or any of these other people who were current modern-day superstars, every once in a while, when I interviewed Doug Flutie, it's like, okay, that's Doug Flutie. I mean, I knew about Doug Flutie even though I didn't, pay much attention to it back in when he was in college. But it's like, okay, some of these people, you get a little excited because, it's a big name and it's fun. But I was never drawn to them because of they were one of my favorites, or I'd watched them for years, or this was just because I was a baseball fan. It was more an appreciation of, in my opinion, I really do believe this, of who they are and how connecting them with the kids out there who were listening to them and watching them would would relate and how I could be that person. And so I think I did go into it not asking a bunch of questions about numbers and stats. And sure, did I say, you know, what does it take to become the best closer in the, you know, at the time when Trevor, you know, set that record? Yeah, of course. You know, I interviewed him in 1998 when nobody knew much about this Trevor Hoffman guy, and he wanted it that way. So I didn't go in and say, hey, Trevor, you're so awesome and I'm a huge fan. It was like, I want to know what it was like growing up with your brothers and what was it like growing up, you know, with only one kidney. Well, tell me about that and who were your influences? And this is my natural, my way of interviewing someone when given the opportunity to have some time. So I think that did give people a new perspective, and I think the players, quite frankly, appreciated that. If you notice, Rick, in the book, there are lots of little sections where the players were interviewed either by myself or by a colleague, or they just replied to an email saying, you know, this was a different type of interview. You were honest. You listened. You seemed compassionate. And that, believe me, I hope there are a lot of reporters and a lot of interviewers who have those same qualities. I would never pretend to be the only person who actually approaches it that way. It sounds like you do too. But I wanted to stay true to myself and still be – I always went into it saying, look, if someone like me is watching the show, I want to make sure they're not lost in the statistics, but I want a diehard sports fan to not feel like I'm talking down to them because I'm having to explain something. So I found I had to find that balance in writing and telling the story, you know, that would connect with both sports fans and, you know, diehards and casual fans and the players. And I did, I think, because I approached it how I would want it to make sense in a story once the final product hit. So I do think I brought a different perspective that maybe wasn't really happening 15 years ago. Maybe it was, but certainly not here.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is very interesting how you went about it. And again, yeah, I think that it really is a balance, as you say, between, you know, keeping it accessible to people and, you know, not, you know, making it too simplistic. I mean, that's never good when you're acting like you're having to speak slowly to people so that they can get it. So it's a real balance on that. You are right. The one thing I got to say where I do part company with you is that as somebody who is a lifelong sports fan, I mean, to this day, I'm still having to swat down the butterflies whenever Mr. Cervillo is getting any of the big names booked for us here. So, you know, my perspective on that has been a little bit different. And although again, as you said, when you're dealing with somebody who's, you know, forget sports, an American icon like Ted Williams, you know, surely you had those moments yourself too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it might not have been the case for every middle infielder that was walking through the door, but when it's Ted Williams, I think anybody's going to be a little bit faint.
Yeah. Well, if you read that section of my book, and I've told the story many times because I, you know, the very first time, I mean, we out here in San Diego have what's called the Ted Williams Parkway, which was named for Ted Williams, of course, back in the mid 90s. Well, I, you know, I was driven on it. I'd seen it, but it's never really connected with me. I knew that he was an idol, you know, someone that Tony Gwynn looked up to, but I just didn't have him on my radar as the impact that this man had made in the game because it was so new. I had only been doing it a couple of years. Well, then I get a phone call and they say, hey, you know, he's going to be here. We would like you to do an interview. And I thought, well, you know what, let me just get right back to you on that. And I hung up. I thought, is someone going to be interested in someone, you know, and someone, you know, an 81-year-old man who's played at the game, but he's not current. Will the young people care? And I picked up the phone and I called two people. And within about 10 seconds, it was like, oh, okay. So I called back and I said, yes, it would be an honor to interview Ted Williams. And it really wasn't that I didn't respect that. I just wasn't sure if that was going to be something that people would be interested or relate to. And, you know, to this day, people still, they, you know, that was one of your best interviews and we enjoyed it. But what they know, if they talk to me about it, I prepared for 6 weeks before I interviewed him. I read his book. I talked to people who have interviewed him, who might have interviewed him. And Absolutely. I felt like a college kid, you know, studying, cramming for an exam. And I got there that day, and my heart was pounding, and the butterflies were there because I knew the pressure was on. I mean, this was a man who normally did not really, he certainly didn't suffer any fools, and he was not a big fan of the media. So, but as soon as I sat down and I got that first question out, it was like, Jane, you know, go for it. This is what you do. And it was one of the most enjoyable hour and 15 minutes of my life. It was really amazing.
Well, that's a great story. And yeah, as you indicated also, yeah, told very well in the book and very illustrative of the fact that while you're based out of San Diego, again, it's anything but just, Padres and Chargers that we're talking about here. You got Ted Williams, who's out there, Phil Mickelson, Doug Flutie, as you indicated, mm-hmm. You had a conversation with others as well. So just, such a great variety of folks that you talked to. But in terms of when the book went to press, there was one thing that you had a chance to address, one thing that you didn't, because I look at this and you dealt with athletes that were poster children for two of the biggest sociological stories probably of the last 20 years. You addressed mm-hmm. in the book Ken Caminiti, as you said, your first interview, a guy who ends up being one of the poster children for steroids and unfortunately is no longer with us, maybe in large reason because of that. Another one of your interviews, Junior Seau, and of course the book went to press before his final chapter was told, unfortunately, and I don't know exactly what you'd call him a poster child for other than just the general post-football kind of thing here. I don't know that they necessarily confirmed that he had that brain syndrome, but clearly there were things that were not right with him as a result of his time in the NFL. So you talked about it in the book a little bit with Caminiti and what your thoughts were on that, but please share your thoughts on both of these athletes. I mean, you got to see them really at their best. You got to tell the stories of what they had going on, but how do you process what has since come out about both of them since then?
Well, first of all, with Ken Caminiti, when I interviewed him in 1997, quite frankly, nobody was talking about or even asking the question about steroid use. Nobody was. They might have, the GMs and people of the baseball world may have known about it, thought about it, noticed it, but it was not part of the conversation. And it was, frankly, never something that I even thought to ask. I mean, we saw his vitamin bag, and I'm thinking he has a trainer, and he's a big buff guy, and there you go. I didn't ever do a follow-up interview with him in terms of television after that year. I did a brief one, but really didn't touch about that. Although in that interview, we did talk about his addiction and issues with drinking. So we did explore his challenges. He was quite open about it. And while he continued to struggle with that, I think the fact that the last time I had a conversation with him was at spring training of the year he died. And, I could see in his eyes how much he wanted, to get better and to change and to be on the right path. And he was working towards that. But, I would never be the person to judge. When I look at Ken Caminiti, we all have issues, and his were sadly, led to his death. But he really was such a strong person in my eyes, not only how he played, even despite all that, but how he was willing to admit and to bring this problem to light. I credit him for that, and I do believe I wrote that in the book. I credit him for his honesty, and I think that really did help change the game, and I think a lot of people appreciate that, even though at the time, it was pretty hard to accept that a lot of this was going on. In terms of Junior, again, none of us knows what was going on with him and why. Clearly, it was a shock to all of us. And, you use the term poster child. I use him as a great example of what you do with your platform. Mm-hmm. And that is not to be naive that, he was imperfect and that it was such a sad thing at the end for him to take his own life. I mean, it really hit not only San Diego, but a lot of people in this who looked up to him as someone who had done the right thing with how the examples he set, the work he did, the good he did with his organization, the Junior Seau Foundation. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist. We were all in shock, but I just believe that when those things, you know, other people deal with it differently, and it's sad what happened, but I look at him still as an icon when it comes to, for as long as he could, he did good things with his platform. And a lot of athletes, I think, are doing that more and more, and I really like to celebrate that. It doesn't mean that they're perfect and that they, you know, who knows what's going to come of the research and the science, but he was an intense and passionate man. And for me, he was someone I knew and respected, and he always said, hey, there's my girl. I mean, he really had a big heart, and we all miss him, and it's very sad, but I think it definitely opened a lot of people's eyes to potential dangers and what the NFL community chooses to do with that. You know, I hope they learn something, but who's to say really what happened or why it happened?
Well, those are very good pictures you painted of both of those men, and you know, how they should be remembered and how I think they would want to be remembered. I'm curious, in the case of Junior Seau, it's a thing I know for a lot of folks like myself who, you know, our formative years, you know, into adulthood were formed watching the guy seemingly forever on the football field. Just what a shock it was, and talking to my friends and people of my generation. I wonder what it was like out there in San Diego, the sense of shock. I know that, unfortunately, a lot of his teammates from that Super Bowl team are no longer with us. So are people starting to get at all numbed out there to this kind of thing, or did it kind of hit home even more because he's such an icon out there? And, you know, all communities, you know, we all have our icons. We can all picture the equivalent of, you know, if us and such passed away in our community. What was it like out there that week once it broke?
Oh, it was devastating. Everybody was devastated. It was, you know, even if you weren't a huge Chargers fan, you appreciated Junior Seau. I mean, there are kids for 20 years, you know, the Junior Seau Foundation, little kids who have benefited from the impact that he's made every year, the Shop of the Jock, and, you know, going in, you know, all these children who, you know, have been grown up with them, and fans, people like me, who I'm a native San Diegan. I mean, I knew about Junior Seau before I became really a sports, you know, observer. And having known him personally, it was shocking. And, you know, this community, to see any of the images, you would know how we responded, because he was such, and not an icon who was up on a pedestal. This was a guy who would, when you're walking around, he would talk to people. He did not have that sense that he was not approachable. He was approachable, and he did things that interacted with fans and did such nice things that, in general, you know, people liked him. You know, I didn't know him. I wasn't on his inner circle, but I certainly knew a lot of people who were, and I knew him mostly from his, you know, from playing and from his charity work. But it was very sad. But I think what we, most everyone, and I went to both the private services and the big one at Qualcomm Stadium, was let's look at this man's life. And the one thing that I thought was so important that we heard from LaDainian Tomlinson and others, but the example he set for young players and why they got involved in charity. Now, does that mean that he was perfect? No. Does that? No, of course not. But none of us is. But I think that is what we all embrace, that we knew that he would always, his legacy was not only how he played and how he was the first guy, you know, who showed up in the to work out, you know, on his 5 o'clock morning workouts, but, and his incredible passion on the field, but how he did not let that be his only legacy. So, you know, the one thing that I took a little, I don't want to say exception to, but when they said, you know, he got out of the game and how was he going to deal with it, this is a man who had lots of things going for him. He was well-known. He had lots of businesses. He was very involved. Now, what's the real story with some of those things? Maybe it wasn't as fulfilling, or we don't know. But we were very sad, but we really came together as a community to celebrate his life, which is not a trite thing. I think it's what people should do when they lose somebody who's very special and certainly in our minds too young.
Absolutely, and yeah, there was a lot of extrapolation, out there. Maybe a little bit of it irresponsible in the days afterwards, as people were trying to piece together what this all meant.
Yeah.
I wanted to definitely take a little bit of time to take a look at the business side of something here with you, because I find this to be very interesting. When I got your book and I was starting to look into some of this, the whole notion of how the channel that launched One-on-One came to be. This was, I guess, right about at the dawn of when teams were doing their own networks, the Yankees with Yes Network.
Right.
But this does not sound like that model exactly. It's not like the Padres were owning the thing, but yet it sounds like it's very much at the dawn of when that was coming into the game here in the mid to late 90s here. So talk, if you would, about that thing getting set up. I know you were coming right off the heels of something that Cox Cable was doing with the Republican National Convention the summer before and some of that. But it seems to be a very interesting kind of, sense, because very few teams were really doing anything like that. And it seems like the Padres and this whole business angle that they come up with, it was on the cutting edge at the time.
Yeah, well, it was really very innovative. I mean, Nesson was happening out in Boston, so there was a big, very much of a regional sports network there. But not too much was happening. This was 1996, and what had happened, I was hired by Cox to help create this channel just for the Republican National Convention. It was not it was bipartisan. It was not partisan. It wasn't political. It was really kind of telling the San Diego story to the visitors and that sort of thing. So Larry Lucchino, who at the time was the president of the Padres, and Bill Gephardt, who was the vice president and general manager of Cox Communications, which is, a huge cable company based out of Atlanta, but this was our, local San Diego offices. They came together, meeting of the minds, and basically they said, if we put more games on television, people will get to know the players, they'll get to know the team, and there will be this great, relationship. And, the naysayers from way back when they wondered, should they put games on the radio, well, how does it affect the gate? Will people come? Well, they said, people will come, if they get to know who these guys are. So let's put a whole bunch of games on TV, and Channel 4 San Diego, Channel 4 Padres, the original name, became the home of the Padres. It is owned and operated by Cox at the time, and then it went on to be 15 years doing that. And we wanted to be different. We wanted to do the games. We wanted to do the storytelling. And in the beginning, it was all about the team. We expanded to do Chargers, college, high school, and then non-sports programming, and really became a very solid entity in this community and a channel that people looked forward to. We went from 125 games the first couple of years up to, I think, 150. So that's a lot of games. And at the time, we started seeing, and it's totally fine, but Fox Sports started kind of going into a lot of the regions, and they became the rights holders for a lot of stations, and they were always a possibility. But the Padres and Cox both saw this mutually beneficial business setup, and people fell in love with our channel. They fell in love with our shows and the access that we had and the heart that we gave. And I really believe it was very signature San Diego. And clearly I was not the only person. There were several on-air people, very, well-known, and some grew, came on young and early in their careers and were there for a decade. So it was something, too, that it was a great branding for Cox. It was great branding for Padres. It was, but more than just a brand, it stood for something. We stood for San Diego. We loved our team. And we were part of the effort when the new ballpark was eventually built. We told the stories of what other cities had done and the impact that that might make, and it's proven to be very successful. But time goes on and things change, and at the end of the 2011 season, there was a different deal made, and that was with Fox Sports San Diego, who now is the news station and rights holders. So it's been kind of a sad year in a way, but it was an amazing ride. And, you know, there really aren't too many. I believe Yes actually came out. I mean, I'm not sure, but I feel we launched in 1997. I almost want to say they either launched right around there or maybe a year or so, two afterwards. I don't have my, you know, Google in front of me. But, you know, and, you know, for years, the Angels, way back when, you know, they did a pregame show and they did, you know, things with a lot of stories. And Dick Enberg was part of that years ago. But we were all about San Diego, and that, and the Padres were our anchor programming. And man, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot. We went to the World Series our second year. You know, we had a few bad years, but we saw Tony Gwynn hit 3,000. I was there in Montreal when he did, and we were bringing all of this home, and people were coming to the games as well. It did not affect that. I mean, we even had good ratings when the team was doing poorly at times because, you know, people wanted their Padres.
Absolutely. People love their team. And again, as you've outlined, you know, very interesting story, even if you just look at the business side of it and how it came to be and your role in helping to shape the channel and your work that was done there. And again, this all can be captured. It was captured by you very well in this book, One-on-One, My Journey with Hall of Famers, Fan Favorites, and Rising Stars. And I want to mention also, too, obviously, that anything that people want to continue to track with you can be found at janemitchellone-on-one.com. That's one-on-one spelled out, so I want to give a plug there. But, Jane, I mean,
thank
anything
you
that we didn't hit sufficiently that you'd like to put out there, please be my guest.
You know, I think for me, when I was writing the book, and, you know, there's this thing called an afterword, and my publisher was saying, I need your afterword, I need that. It's like, oh my gosh, what is that? And it really gave me a chance after I had worked at this point 14 years and, you know, worked on the book for 4 years. I sat there and I reflected and I thought about my personal journey, my experience with athletes, and the things that I learned. And, you know, I'm not a Pollyanna. I understand that it's so important to explore the positives and negatives of all of our journeys and our lives, to not only for ourselves, but also what we can pass on to others. And what I realized I was doing was what I call now the good sports story. It's that we should celebrate athletes at all levels who are doing good things with where they are in the game or even after the game. It's about making sure that we remember to make the headline the guy who helps kids at a camp or donates to cancer or whatever that is. And so many people are doing so many things like that, that I think it's easy to say, oh, there's always a bad story. These athletes are overpaid and they're this and they're that. And, you know, it's sad when sometimes the guys who make the mistakes and make the headlines, but I am just hoping to be part of a paradigm shift that will at least not ignore those good stories. ESPN at times is amazing with that. They tell some wonderful stories. HBO can show some great things. But I just think it's something that even in our own communities, we can support these athletes who are doing good things. So it's it doesn't mean that if someone does something bad, they shouldn't be, you know, called out on it. But I do think it gives us a little bit more, gave me at least, a little different kind of spectrum to look at athletes rather than just the big money and the big contracts and all of that. So that's really been, for me, the joy of all of this. And I hope to keep it going one way or the other, whether it's through my website, through expanding the show in another way, doing interviews. But I would love to hear people's comments on that, and I hope that they'll visit my website, janemitchellone-on-one.com, see some of the excerpts from the shows that they probably couldn't see unless they're in San Diego, and share your story, because sometimes, you know, just by sharing your story about an experience with an athlete, you're reminded that there really is a lot of good that can come of that world of sports.
Very well said. And again, as you indicated, yeah, the best stories come from really going to more of a three-dimensional place and really kind of getting those kind of tidbits out of the subject. And you've clearly done that very well through the course of your 100-plus interviews with One-on-One. And as I knew it would, Jane. The time flew by very quickly today. We'd love to have you back on and get some more stories
Anytime.
Out of you. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on with us today, Jane.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. It's really been our pleasure. Great to have you on, and thanks for tuning in, everybody. Mini episode number 194 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.